Mark chapter 1 and verse 1. The Gospel of Mark chapter 1, verse 1. The words, the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And our title this evening is Mark's Distinctive Gospel. And I'm making a kind of digression from the announced subject, the dissolving of doubts for this single week. And you'll recall that just very recently, we were looking at the differences between the Gospels, inspired by complaints that there are discrepancies between the Gospels, that their records are not in accordance with each other, and we looked at a number of these issues. Most of the so-called discrepancies between the Gospels are very easily resolved. Only a few are slightly more difficult. But one of the main reasons for people to see discrepancies in the Gospels is that they don't understand, they don't grasp that the Gospels, by the inspiration of God, do differ in character, not in facts, not in content, but in character. They have different aims, different purposes. They're not just inspired by the Spirit of God for random and varied accounts just for the sake of it. They have either inspired the gospel writers to bring out different points, to have different themes, to have different objectives, and we looked at some of those. And if people don't understand those basic facts about the Gospels, then they will imagine that they see discrepancies which are not really there. They are, in fact, consistent. And so I'm going to spend our time this evening just looking at one, looking at Mark's Gospel and some of its distinctive features. Now, critics of the Bible, unbelievers in an inspired Bible, who dedicate themselves to trying to find fault and who don't understand the things that I've been describing, they have a hypothetical source for the Gospels. It could be in the form of oral tradition, though they speak of it as though it's a document. And there is the mysterious hypothetical Q document from which the Gospel writers all drew. This is their theory, this is their approach. Such a document, which was a source for the other Gospels, there's no trace of it in history, no shreds of it, items of it have ever been found, despite the thousands of pieces of early Gospels which we do have and which have been found. There's no sign of any Q, of any source document for anything, and it's only a theory, an idea. But armed with this idea, they say, well, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John copied differently from that common source. And they then, as I mentioned, try to produce supposed discrepancies, which in fact are not there. We considered some of the differences a few weeks ago. Gospel of Matthew is written to Jews. It's quite long. Its main burden is to prove that Jesus is the Messiah. And it seeks to prove that Christ is Messiah by going to the prophecies of the Old Testament and quoting them or alluding to them repeatedly through its pages. And so it demonstrates to Jewish minds that Christ is the prophesied, predicted Messiah. Mark's Gospel is entirely different. It's in its approach, probably the very first of the Gospels to be written. Favorite theory, well, of traditionalists is around 64, perhaps as late as AD 70, but very early at any rate, and by the one who is traditionally thought to be its author, Mark, but I'll go into that a little later on. Mark's Gospel is quite different from Matthew's. It's clearly written for Gentiles, and it uses Latin words, and it laboriously explains Jewish customs as though it's written for Gentiles who wouldn't understand what Jews do or what they mean by the things which they do. So it has a different aim. It's a Gentile gospel. It's very, very short by comparison with Matthew. It's half the length of Luke's gospel, and it has all the marks of having been written as a kind of tract. It's strange, really, that when we want to use a gospel as a tract, we tend to use the Gospel of John. All Christians do. They go for the Gospel of John. But the Gospel of Mark is actually the one that was more clearly written as a brief tract to show people the essence of the gospel. The Gospel of John, I'm not complaining about using it as a tract. It's a wonderful, wonderful tract. But oddly, it seems to have more been written for Christian believers than for unbelievers. And it majors on the words of Christ, has more of the words of Christ than any of the others. But it's Mark's, which was originally the tract of the New Testament. Also, it would seem. Now, Luke's gospel, which was also written for Gentiles, much longer than Mark's, and seeks to be quite different. Matthew's gospel proves that Jesus was the Messiah from the Old Testament prophecies. Mark's gospel proves that Jesus is the Messiah not from that direction, but by his works. It majors on the divine nature of his works rather than his words. Luke's gospel has an entirely different purpose. It clearly is more of a biography, and it's following the life, and it's constructed and shaped much more, almost as a modern biography might be. John's gospel assumes that its readers are familiar with the other gospels and passes over a great deal that they have, not all, but a great deal, and focuses on the words of Christ and their spiritual meaning and their depth. So they all set out with different intentions given to them by the Spirit of God, inspired by the Spirit of God. Never forget, when you read the Gospel of John, that in chapter 14 of John's Gospel and in chapter 16, Christ repeats himself to the disciples, and he tells them that when the Holy Spirit comes, he will lead them, the future apostles, the disciples, the 12, but of course without Judas, he will lead them into all the truth. A very important phrase. Would bring to their memory everything that Christ said and did. And they would be those who would be responsible either for writing or authenticating what prophets wrote in the New Testament. It would all be committed to the disciples. They would have the divine recollection and inspiration accurately and perfectly of everything. So within their lifetimes, they wrote or endorsed the gospel records. We generally believe, and maybe I have time to touch on the little bit of evidence for this, but we generally believe that Mark wrote the Gospel of Mark, largely dictating what the Apostle Peter gave him. The Apostle Peter, in his first epistle, in chapter 5, calls Mark his son. He was his closest fellow labourer in later life. He was the one who acted as his secretary. He was the one who wrote the Greek, probably translating large amounts of Aramaic that Peter himself wrote down and presented it in this breathless form that we have in the Gospel of Mark. So it has a unique structure, Christ, the miracle worker. But I'd like to go through a few things and to try to help you to see the whole Gospel. Now, first of all, I'm going to make mention of verse 1, the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That's the first theme, the Son of God. And that occurs towards the end of the Gospel, chapter 15, verse 39, where he names the Son of God again. And between those two references, the first verse and chapter 15, verse 39, there are seven exclamations that Christ is the Son of God. followed by indications and evidence. So that's one of the themes of the Gospel of Mark. It's a cable that runs through the Gospel. Christ is the Son of God. He has interesting sub-themes which run through his Gospel also. No other Gospel is quite like Mark in setting up a drama of comparisons. So, for instance, he will record a number of Christ's healings and great preachings and successes, if you like, and achievements, we may use human terms, and then he'll move the spotlight to the hostility and the opposition, and then he'll proceed with further accounts of Christ's great acts of power and his great sermons in summary. And then once again, he'll put the spotlight on opposition. And I hope to show you this, but that's a theme that repeats through Mark. The others don't do it quite as he does it. And you can see why he has, in many cases, a different order of events from Matthew or Luke, because Mark isn't inspired to put things in chronological order. He is inspired to show how each group of mighty deeds is followed by a wave of opposition. That's one of his themes. Then again, the pattern recurs and recurs. He's got a very interesting and unique literary structure running through the Gospel. And people who don't know that, don't observe that, don't notice that, say, well, why is this or that in a different order? It's because each Gospel has a different plan, a different point that is being proved, and different sub-themes running through. These are not just haphazard accounts. They're very sophisticated. You study the Gospels as literature, they're extremely sophisticated and ordered in their way, and it's not difficult to discover what that is. So Mark, for example, in the miracles, which are there to prove that Christ is divine, actually follows another suborder: Christ's power over the wind and the waves, Christ's power over evil spirits, Christ's power over diseases, Christ's power over death. And you can see them following one after the other. So the order of events has been arranged by Mark in that gospel to show off those themes and those developments. So it's quite different from the more biographical Luke in places. And if you understand there's a purpose and the Holy Spirit is teaching in a different manner in each one, you understand the differences in style and order. Mark's is the roughest gospel. It's the most ungarnished. There are very few embellishments in the Gospel of Mark. Mark's is the most, this is frequently described in this way, the most breathless gospel. He doesn't bother about joining up the events, any little cadenzas in between. He moves straight from one event to another, very abruptly and sharply. And if you're reading the Gospel of Mark, well, there's a possibility you'll find yourself getting breathless. He's on the move all the time. It's his Spirit-inspired method of keeping his readers. This is, of course, it was on a scroll, so what I'm going to say is nonsense, but it's his page-turner, if you like, this breathless pace that he follows as he passes from event to event. People have to keep reading him because you feel you're breaking off if you stop. And he even begins very abruptly. He omits the nativity, proceeds straight to the ministry of John the Baptist, and he's away, and it's on the move. And almost every chapter heading that has been imposed in later history, chapter headings, of course, came a lot later, every chapter heading feels as though it's in the wrong place, because Mark isn't stopping. He's moving all the time from one end to the other. So insert a chapter, it's going to look unnatural, and it almost always does. And one of his favourite words is immediately, differently translated in our elegant King James Version. Sometimes it's translated as straightway, sometimes as forthwith, and so on. But same word in the Greek, and he uses it 40 times through the Gospel. I'm going to have a little look at that later on, because it's marvellous the way, the meaning that comes out of every passage in which he uses the term immediately or forthwith. It has been said that he had very limited vocabulary, Mark. That it's probably not the Apostle Peter's fault, it's Mark and his Greek writing, because, and it is a limited vocabulary gospel. And so it can be understood by the simplest of people. And they say, or they have said, that this constant use of immediateness and forthwiths is a blemish. It isn't a blemish, because you can stop and do a little word study yourself every time you see that word. I'll show you how in a minute. And you can say, well, in what context is he using it now? What is he intending to convey by this, his most popular word, as he goes through his gospel? I'm speaking in human terms. He is spirit-inspired, of course. He always stresses fear and amazement in the minds of the people. He's very vivid, not in with literary flourish, but he's very vivid, more vivid than Matthew, even though briefer. The demon-possessed man of Gadara, who was in the tombs night and day and cut himself, always giving more information on things you can visualize than the others. With the feeding of the 5,000, only Mark tells us that they sat on green grass and things like that. And he's often doing that. Luke will say a little more about the physical condition of the person, probably related to his being a physician. But Mark will always give you a picture to visualize in your mind and in few words. And so that's something which crops up as an addition to him always. Well, friends, the first theme is Christ as the Son of God. The second theme is Christ's sufferings. You see a suffering Saviour. Even before you come to the last part of Mark's Gospel, which is about the final week of Christ's life and the suffering and death of Christ, half the book is 8 chapters in which you find constant mention of Christ's suffering, even before Calvary, his persecutions. Look, we'll look at some of them. I'll take you to chapter 1 here, and verse 21 and 22. They went into Capernaum, and straightway on the Sabbath, look at this verse in another context again, he entered into the synagogue and taught, and they were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one that had authority and not as the scribes. Well, that's success, if you like. They're all listening, and they're amazed at what he teaches. Then you look down to verse 27. They were all amazed. This is the casting out of an unclean spirit, insomuch that they questioned among themselves, saying, what thing is this? What new doctrine is this? For with authority commandeth he even the unclean spirits, and they do obey him. And immediately his fame spread abroad throughout all the region round about Galilee. And you can go on to verse 33, more success. And all the city was gathered together at the door, and he healed many that were sick of diverse diseases, and cast out many devils, and so on. And then down to verse 45, where you read, but he went out and began to publish it much, and to blaze abroad the matter, insomuch that Jesus could no more openly enter into the city, but people came out to where he was in the countryside in vast crowds. And in chapter 2, you see the success is building up at breathless pace. And again he entered into Capernaum after some days, and it was noised that he was in the house. And straightway many were gathered together, insomuch that there was no room to receive them, no, not so much as about the door. And then the four borne down through the roof of the building, and the great crowds outside. But then you come to chapter 2, verses 6 and 7. But there were certain of the scribes sitting there and reasoning in their hearts, Why doth this man speak blasphemies? Who can forgive sins but God only? And Christ has to deal with that. Then you have another long series of successes in chapter 2, verse 16, and chapter 3, verse 1, and then in chapter 3, verse 2, back to persecution. And they watched him, whether he would heal on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him. And he did, and they were furious and against him and resented it. And you can go down to verse 6 of chapter 3. Hope you don't mind this kind of study. This was after the healing of the man with the withered hand. The Pharisees went forth and straightway took counsel with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him. And Mark is very careful to do this constantly and to record all the opposition. So a string of wonderful deeds and then the opposition. You get it down there in chapter 3, verses 10 to 11. For he had healed many, insomuch that they pressed upon him for to touch him, as many as had plagues. And unclean spirits, when they saw him, fell down before him and cried out. But in no time at all, there's trouble again. Down in verse 22, and the scribes which came down from Jerusalem said, He hath Beelzebub, and by the prince of the devils casteth he out devils. And Mark tracks it all the time, the running opposition and the persecution and the hostility. So that's one of his themes all the way through the first eight chapters of Mark's gospel. And there's another theme. Let me tell you about this. Mark, like, well, none of the others, Matthew, Luke, John, Mark traces not only Christ's mission, but the disciples' blindness to it. And he does this for a number of reasons. And I'm going to try and show you a contrast between Matthew and Mark on this. And you'll see, get an insight into the differences between the Gospels. Matthew chapter 17, verses 9 and 10. And as they came down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, saying, Tell the vision to no man until the Son of Man be risen again from the dead. This was following the transfiguration of Christ and the four disciples that witnessed Christ's glory. So here in verse 10, and his disciples asked him, saying, Why then say the scribes that Elias must first come? And Christ answered that question. But in Mark's gospel, you get more information, and this highlights one of Mark's burdens by the Spirit of God. Mark 9 and verse 9, a supposedly parallel passage. And as they came down from the mountain, he charged them that they should tell no man what things they had seen till the Son of Man were risen from the dead. And they kept that saying with themselves, questioning one another what the rising from the dead should mean. And they asked him, saying, Why say the scribes that Elias must first come? Now, Matthew didn't tell us that they had a bigger question in their minds that they were evidently afraid to ask him. And they didn't understand what this was all about anyway, rising from the dead. And Mark repeats this, words to the same effect, several times. He's taking on board, by the inspiration of the Spirit, a task that Matthew doesn't have, to track the failure of the disciples to understand the real purpose of Christ's death and resurrection. They hadn't got it yet, and he keeps drawing attention to this. That's unusual. There's no discrepancy between Matthew and Mark. Mark has a burden, which isn't given to Matthew, to bring out an additional theme. It's like a cable running through the book. The ignorance and misunderstanding of the disciples on the central things. So I could take you to another passage, almost following, Matthew 17, verse 22, and you'll see the subtle difference. And while they abode in Galilee, Jesus said unto them, The Son of Man shall be betrayed into the hands of men, and they shall kill him. And the third day he shall be raised again. And they were exceeding sorry. Well, that doesn't tell you a lot. The disciples were sorry. Mark's going to tell you more in his much shorter gospel that they didn't have a clue what he was talking about. He's going to add to this. He's got a special burden about this. So you turn to Mark 9 and verse 31 and you read this. For he taught his disciples and said unto them, The Son of Man is delivered into the hands of men, and they shall kill him. And after that he is killed, he shall rise the third day. But they understood not that saying, and were afraid to ask him. The conclusion there is in verses 32 to 34. And you can see what they're disputing about, and how in verse 32 they're afraid to ask him. And it's vital to grasp his mission. But there are probably a bundle of reasons why Mark is inspired to bring this out. Some people say, critics, unbelievers, they say the disciples made all this up. Christ's extraordinary person did do some seemingly wonderful things, but the theology of it, that he came to suffer and to die, to make an atonement and to rise from the dead and to give life to believers who would one day all rise from the dead with resurrection bodies, all that, they say, was a theological elaboration imposed on this by the disciples. They made it all up. Yes, but in Mark's gospel, running right through, you find the disciples actually were the slowest on the uptake with all this. They didn't understand it. Things were being explained to them by Christ. I will suffer and die, rise from the dead. And they didn't understand it, and it was a mystery. And it troubled them. They weren't just sorry, and they were frightened to ask him. It was too deep for them. The disciples lagged a long way behind. They weren't sharp as a needle people making up a theology to impose upon the life of Christ. They were people who had to be brought by the Lord to understand it. They were slow, they were behind. You see, that's probably one of the reasons why Mark is inspired to record their reactions in the way he uniquely does. From chapter 11 in Mark's Gospel, it's all about the last week, the most important part to Mark. I won't go into that now because I want to just give time to dealing with the immediately texts. Prophecies in the Gospel of Mark, prophecies of Christ, that is. Believing is a key theme of Mark's Gospel. Believing crops up repeatedly. It wasn't very long ago we looked at Mark 16, but I'm always asked so many questions about this. Perhaps it's not a bad idea if I very quickly refer to it again, because in chapter 16 you get the climax of Mark's running emphasis on believing, believing, believing. And here is, in Mark chapter 16, the passage which we may call the Pentecostal problem. For 1900 years of church history, everybody understood what Christ meant in his instruction for the disciples in Mark 16. With small exceptions, there were a few people cropped up in church history who didn't understand it, but that was so infrequently and so minor, and what their ideas were regarded as heresy. But around the turn of the beginning of the 1900s, when Pentecostalism arose, it largely arose because a converted people, in all probability, well-meaning people, didn't know how to expound Mark 16. And they misread it. And they didn't understand it. And that was the birth of Pentecostalism. They meant well, I'm sure. But they made a great mistake. They should have been more cautious. If they'd only have asked themselves, well, why has nobody seen this apart from us? In 1900 years of church history, they would have been a little more careful. But they were so enthusiastic, they rushed ahead. And so Pentecostalism was born, which was not a big branch of Christianity at all until the 1960s, when the charismatic movement came along and expanded these same ideas greatly, and in the course of events picked up the Pentecostal movement and put it in its pocket and became very vast. And this was the problem. A misunderstanding of Mark 16 was the start of all the trouble. So let me just spend a few moments, though we have looked at it recently, looking at verse 14, first of all. Afterward, he, Christ, appeared unto the 11 as they sat at meat and upbraided them, notice the them, it's plural, there are 11 of them, with their unbelief and hardness of heart, because they believe not them which had seen him after he was risen. So they are rebuked, the 11, for their unbelief, when at the first appearances, resurrection appearances of Christ, they didn't believe. So they're reproved. They are believing by now, but Christ is going to warn them that any recurrence or return of unbelief will deprive them of their apostolic privileges and instrumentality. But it's plural. Verse 14, everybody always understood this until the Pentecostalists came along. And they didn't get it. They didn't grasp these verses. So the rebuke of Christ is delivered to them, plural, for their unbelief, the apostles of the future. Now look at verse 15. And he said unto them, go ye into all the world, go ye into all the world, and preach the gospel to every creature. A most significant singular appears. Every creature, singular. Not all people, every creature. Now this is a literary means of distinguishing between the 11 apostles at that time and their converts, their listeners, the people to whom they would preach. It's putting them into two distinctive categories as you read. Them, they, the plural, refers always in this passage to the apostles. The singular, every creature, refers to the first converts. Verse 16, note the singular. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned. Now look carefully at verse 17, where we go back to the plural. We're no longer talking about the converts, we're back to the disciples. This is how the passage distinguishes between them. And these signs shall follow them that believe. Remember verse 14, the them were reproved for their unbelief. Now in verse 17, the them will have signs following them if they believe. This is for the apostles. This isn't for the converts. That was the great mistake of Pentecostalism. They didn't understand the literature of the passage. They didn't observe the plural singular change and the two categories that run through the passage. So they missed it. These signs shall follow them, the apostles, that believe. In my name shall they cast out devils, they shall speak with new tongues, they shall take up serpents, which so far as we're aware was only fulfilled in the Apostle Paul, but it may have been unrecorded in other apostles. And if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover. And the New Testament tells us that it was the apostles that did that, by the hands of the apostles. By the hands of the apostles, the signs and the wonders. That's repeatedly said. Verse 19, so then after the Lord had spoken unto them, we're still with the plural, this is the apostles, he was received up into heaven and sat on the right hand of God, and they, the apostles, went forth and preached everywhere, the Lord working with them and confirming the word with signs following. Now, the correct exegesis of the passage is beyond controversy. The plural and the singular are used throughout to distinguish between the apostles and those first hearers of the apostles, who are singular. So the signs following were for the apostles, not for their converts. And that's how for 1900 years, the church, going through all the times of Reformation and revival, clearly understood it. And Mark particularly is given to deal with this question of belief, because it is his burden all the way through the gospel. And then in the last chapter, have I time? I think you'd appreciate it if I did look at some of the immediatelies. So back to chapter 1 and verse 11, and I shall skip most of them, but you'll see the point. Always pause when you see a Markian immediately and say, what does it mean in this context? Mark is not a poor writer, uninspired, who sprinkles immediatelies and forthwiths all through his gospel with a great pepper pot. Every time he uses an immediately in different contexts, he means something special. This is inspired literature. It's profound. So let me show you very quickly. Chapter 1 and verse 11. And there came a voice from heaven, this is the baptism of Christ, saying, thou art my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. And immediately the Spirit driveth him into the wilderness. And he was there in the wilderness 40 days, tempted of Satan. But it was the Spirit who moved him into the wilderness to face the temptations of Satan. Immediately. Why immediately? Why was the temptation, the terrible, terrible temptation of Christ, being assailed directly from Satan with powerful desires in his human nature, why did it happen immediately? Well, we just pause and we think. And he's our forerunner, as well as our perfect Saviour. He's our forerunner. And that is how the devil works with us. When you've had a great blessing and a great authentication and a wonderful experience of answered prayer, don't be surprised if a great temptation or assault or doubt is launched in very suddenly. Our divine forerunner had to suffer the greatest example of it. The Spirit compelled him into the wilderness at once. There's something to be derived from that immediately. It isn't just a haphazard use of the word. So when you read your Bible, always think of that. What's the context? What may the meaning be for me, or the encouragement? Look at chapter 1 and verse 17. This is the call of the disciples, or at least Simon and Andrew. And Jesus said unto them, come ye after me, and I will make you to become fishers of men. And, same Greek word for immediately, straightway they forsook their nets and followed him. What's to be learned from that? Well, that's how the Spirit works. When the Spirit is at work, there is an immediate compulsion to respond. I may hear the gospel for 6 months or 5 years and dither about and be somewhat inclined and sometimes feel my need and get absolutely nowhere. But when the Spirit works in regenerating power, there's a strange new compulsion about it. I have to respond. It cuts so deeply. That's how the Spirit works. That's our experience. That's how he works in answer to prayer, in conversion. Just note the straight way. Why is it there? What is it telling us? And then we could look down to verse 21. And this is Christ and the disciples. They went into Capernaum, and straightway on the Sabbath day, he entered into the synagogue and taught. Why is there an immediately? What does it emphasize? The Lord never wasted time. The Lord was about his Father's business. The Lord didn't go sightseeing. He went straight to the place where he would preach, where there would also be opposition and persecution. It's an example for us. We don't loiter in the king's business, in the Lord's work. If we're moved to do something, we pray and we seek to get on with it. The immediately puts a message into the passage. It's often in a different context. You could look at verse 28. Oh, I must move to conclusion, but I'll just give you one or two. Immediately his fame spread abroad throughout all the region round about Galilee. His healings were so dramatic. The things that he accomplished, and they were all done immediately. There are so many immediatelys in connection with the healings of Christ that the people, well, the word went round and the people crowded in. Look at the immediatelys here. You've got two in two verses. Immediately his fame spread abroad, verse 28, and forthwith, verse 29. So you look for the meaning of each one. And I must take you down to an opposition verse, chapter 3 and verse 6, and we learn something from this. And the Pharisees went forth and straightway, immediately, took counsel with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him. What had he done? He'd healed the man with the withered hand in the synagogue, but because it was on the Sabbath, that's all that mattered to them. They were so furious, so angry, and they acted at once. And it reminds us that when people are furious against the gospel, or when they're atheists, or whatever, then they'll express their opposition and their hatred pretty quickly. They won't hang around. It happened to the Lord, and it will happen to us. The immediately warns us of something. Here's a lesson which evangelists should have noted and often have failed to do so. Chapter 4 and verse 5, and I'll read one or two verses quickly. Here is the sower and the seed. And the parable reads, verse 5, some fell on stony ground where it had not much earth, and immediately it sprang up. And that immediately is repeated several times. It has its parallel in verse 16 and also verse 17. But I note verse 15, and these are those sown by the wayside, where the word is sown. But when they have heard, Satan cometh immediately, and taketh away the word that was sown in their hands. There's a scattering of five immediatelys in different forms in the course of the telling and the explaining of that parable. What is the message there? Why does everything happen with the stony ground hearers immediately? They spring up immediately, and Satan strikes immediately. Well, it's telling us the emotionalism that often is involved in the hearing and receiving of the gospel. Some people don't react in this way, but many do. And if the man who invented the invitation system years back in history, Charles Finney, had only carefully read this parable of the Lord, he would have known you cannot use emotional manipulation on people, because thousands of people will respond like lightning, like the wayside hearers. They're very emotional and very fickle, and they'll receive the word, and Satan will act just as quickly, and it'll all die away just as quickly, and they'll be lost. You've got to reason with the mind and pray for the power of the Spirit to regenerate the heart and incline the will. It's got to be conviction of sin. People have got to understand what they're doing. The gospel preacher must be highly persuasive, but he mustn't tell sob stories and employ emotional manipulation and yell at the top of his voice at what he thinks are strategic moments. People are vulnerable to all that, and you get thousands of emotional responses, and most of them all fall away. Why? The lesson in pastoral theology is all there, in that sudden burst of five immediatelys, in one passage. They have a meaning. There's a reason for them. There's a lesson. People can respond like lightning to the gospel if you make an emotional assault upon them and fall away just as quickly. I'm really not explaining this adequately. I'm just giving insights into all 40 immediatelys, forthwiths, anons, and all the rest of it in the Gospel of Mark are highly significant in their different contexts. So when we read the Bible, pause. What's it doing there? What's it telling me? What's it warning me of? It really is quite wonderful. Dear friends, you've been very, very patient, and I've been carried away, so I'm going to end at this point, and may God bless this overview of Mark to our hearts. Let's sing together our closing hymn, and it's hymn number 453.